And you're listening to CKLN with Black Uhuru. In the background, you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. You can go to www.ckln.fm and call your friends, enemies, neighbors, and everybody and tell them that Saturday Morning Live is on the air. And Melinda, you had something to say.
I just wanted to let everybody know, because I didn't get a chance to ask Gaddy to plug her film. Her film is Leon Stars. I'm just getting the contact so that I get the website. I don't have the website on me. But I just wanted to, you know, tell everybody to check out, to Google that. It's called Leon Stars, and it's around this soccer league of amputees in Sierra Leone. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that.
All right.
Check out the movie.
And
follow
Saturday,
it. Sorry.
Pardon me. Saturday Morning Live continues.
Shouting for freedom, everybody say shouting for freedom, shouting for freedom, shouting, everybody say shouting for freedom, shouting for freedom, everybody say shouting for freedom,
shouting for freedom, shouting for freedom.
They took our homes. They moved us out of Africville in the city garbage trucks. They didn't want to hear anything from the younger generation because they simply knew that the older people didn't have any education. What is $500 to a 75-year-old Negro? He thinks he's rich. We haven't even got enough to put down one payment for a home. Nothing. I'm living on welfare. You look in the records and see how many Africville people had to humble and come to the city for welfare. We were too independent. We didn't want it. Our boys never had so much trouble until they came in the city.
Down by the blue and Bedford Bays, where catfish jump and ships went sailing, we live.
Need a double cross. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Aye, 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 aye.
Hey! Ho! Clap your hands, clap your hands, clap your hands, clap your hands. Yeah, yeah! Yeah! Yeah!
You are listening to Amandla on CKLN 88.1 FM. Our apologies for starting up late this morning. We are going to be listening to part of an interview conducted by Masoum Momamya, who writes for Women Power in Politics. She's actually a curator for Women Power in Politics. And the she's interviewing Sibongile Masuku Vendam. She is a researcher and environmental activist, and she is talking about culture, gender, and race as it relates to South African environmental challenges. So looking at gender, culture, and race, the intersection of all those three things as it relates to just South African environmental challenges. So we'll be listening to that, to part of that interview this week. And the next time that I am on, we will continue to listen to that interview. So again, you are listening to Amandla on 88.1 FM, CKLN. And this is a production of GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa.
Welcome to the International Museum of Women and this monthly podcast for the exhibition Women, Power, and Politics. Each month, we'll be talking to remarkable leaders from around the globe. This month's topic: how do women save the earth?
When I entered conservation in 1996, we were really not welcome. One, as women. Two, as black women.
Sibongile Masuku is a self-described eco-feminist who's lived and worked in concert with the earth her whole life. She grew up in Swaziland and now works in South Africa. She served as an environmental activist in various capacities and acted as an advisor to the South African government on environmental conservation. Currently, she's a research fellow at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. Women, Power, and Politics curator Masoum Momamya sat down with her recently in Palo Alto, California, to learn about how gender, race, and the environment coexist in post-apartheid South Africa.
Have you always cared about the environment since a very young age?
I think I was very much influenced looking at the environment in a very broad perspective, because my great-grandmother was a traditional healer, but she was also a traditional gynecologist and pediatrician. So everywhere she walked, she looked in terms of plants. And as I grew up as well, being a woman, my grandmother then, we would wake up very early in the morning and go and pick wild spinach. So it was sort of the woman provider kind of role that one was being prepared for. So I could identify from a very young age edible plants that could be used for providing for the family.
And do you find, is that specific to the South African context?
I think particularly for young women, we grow up knowing which plants are edible and which are not, and what would generally be used in the home. When I grew up and working as a conservationist, it was quite interesting where you start seeing the plants now being categorized in terms of alien species and non-alien species, because you've grown up with plants like kutuza, which is the blackjack, and all of a sudden it's being dubbed an alien plant, but it has been a provider of nutrients for you from a very young age.
Who is doing the dubbing? Who's classifying plants?
I think the movement, particularly in South Africa now, is very much the attack of the alien, and the alien here is the invader plant. So it's quite a big environmentalist movement. But its value is in the sense that it's very much aimed at the poorest of the poor. And in this respect, it's usually the women.
So I want to go back to that notion of alien and non-alien plants, but first I'm wondering if you can tell us, what is a conservationist and what do they do?
I call myself an environmentalist, which is much broader.
Okay.
Because conservationists are more concerned with plants and animals, but environmentalists is concerned about social issues, decisions, political decisions in terms of provision economically, in terms of what the budget is going to look like and all. So it's really about the interdependence of the economic, social and political in terms of its impact on biodiversity and the relationship.
And have conservationists historically neglected those social factors, especially, or for example, in the case of classification of plants? Has that been a tension within the environmental movement in the sense of conservationists neglecting some of the social factors?
I think conservation has really started off, particularly in South Africa, from a purist point of view. No people, no alien species. And I think with recognizing that the encroachment of alien species is not necessarily an issue of the fences. Birds are involved, humans are involved in terms of history. I mean, the English have been there with their horses, they wanted to provide fodder. So you have a historical issue of alien plants being there. But I think particularly with 1994 and the new dispensation and the instruction to conservation that it must start now being relevant to people's issues. One of the areas that was recognized as being able to answer that call was to look at how to clean up the spaces, the environmental spaces.
And could you say more about that, the dispensation and the cleaning up of environmental spaces?
Mostly South African national parks were enclaves for white people, the playgrounds, and particularly black people were just oiling the machine for tourism, and they had no benefits beyond just being the workers.
Laborers.
The laborers. So when Mandela's government took over, we were told either shut down or we really revise our brief in terms of making sure that people derive value from conservation. It should no longer become an island in space and not reflect the issues that are within or just at the step of their fences. The South African National Parks then started what was called social ecology program. But of course, even though one was going to look at the issues of redressing historical disadvantages, it could not just happen without internal transformation in the organization for people to really rethink how they're running their everyday business. So that was quite a challenge because these were embedded attitudes that were just really at the heart of forming policies for running the organization. And there was extreme resistance.
There were some interesting ways in which you were received as a black woman within a movement that was predominantly white men. Is that correct?
Yes. When I entered conservation in 1996, remember this is 2 years after a new constitution, we were really not welcome. One, as women. Two, as black women. We're constantly asked, oh, Sibongile, what do you know about conservation? So we were really seen as sort of a window dressing lot that so had to play a public relations role to appease government. And you really, really had to stand up and be assertive as a woman. And you also had to have an understanding of what the business you were in was about, because I came in as a social scientist. But most of the time, your colleagues would question your understanding of conservation, and they would argue with you that there was no space here for dealing about people issues. We're not a developmental agency. That's for government to provide for the poor. Our business here is clear. It's conservation. So you had to constantly justify your role in conservation. And it got ugly quite a number of times.
And so how did you respond to that? It seems to me that, you know, we started at the very beginning, that you would know quite a bit about conservation, given that you had grown up with this knowledge of plants and you had been passed down from generation to generation and really had a very specific understanding of the environment.
You see, that's exactly the arrogance that conservation started off with. Black people have no understanding of what conservation is. So the whole layer of indigenous knowledge in terms of how people related with the environment was all of a sudden erased. My prior knowledge of conservation issues, my common sense understanding of conservation was not regarded. So part of the work that I did was to develop a series of booklets which were called the Indigenous Knowledge Series. First of all, it was to provide evidence of the fact that our indigenous knowledge sits at the same table as conservation, as the so-called labeled conservation knowledge. I developed one which was called Sweetwater, which would it was a story in Zulu explaining how people collected water. For instance, people would collect water where they could hear it, which means it was oxygenated water. And water, when it was collected, you'd brush the surface, which means you get rid of the surface bacteria. And people wouldn't collect water after a storm because generally the water wouldn't be healthy. So there were quite a number of practices that had scientific wisdom behind it. And it was not just only in the area of work, but it's also in the area of school, where kids were told, oh, don't bring that nonsense knowledge from home. It's not science. So it also meant reteaching teachers how to approach the so-called indigenous knowledge and to bring out those scientific rationales within the practices that people did.
And I know you had mentioned to me as well that you did some work in schools, and you just mentioned sharing some of this training teachers and working with teachers. Mm-hmm. Did you find that there was more receptivity among young people to kind of integrating this knowledge and overcoming the stereotypes about specific racial groups and their lack of knowledge or their particular mm-hmm. knowledges about the environment? Mm-hmm.
One particular project that I was involved in was called the 2020 Vision for Water. It was a government project, mainly driven by white male, and it was going to look at water quantity in the whole of South Africa. Now, that's a controversial question, because water was mainly in the hands of the privileged. And people in the rural areas had not been provided for. So when I was asked to come in and join the project, I just said, this is just not making any sense. We can't only just be looking at water quantity. We also need to look at water quality. If you're going to be auditing how much water a school is using in a swimming pool, it's a joke, because some schools don't even have swimming pools in South Africa. You're going to look at how much water is used for washing cars. The kids don't have parents that have cars. So we had to, if you look at areas like the Kalahari, there's absolutely no water, so what are you auditing? So we had to really revolutionize the project and start working with women, particularly women teachers, to say, what are the real issues that you're dealing with in the classroom with regard to water? And the issues they came up with was, look, as a teacher, because I have a car, I bring a bucket of water into the classroom for the kids to be able to drink. As for washing hands after the toilet, that's an extravagance that we can't afford because we have pit latrines. And if you put the water next to the pit latrine, the kids will drink it. And washing hands is just not an issue. So it actually opened up some of the critical water issues in the country. And the fact that you're going to look at how much water is wasted through taps, you had to look at how much time women spend walking from their huts to the river to fetch the water. So working with teachers and the youth, part of the resources that we looked at were to say, audit your environment. Look at who's living above your township. Interview your grandparents in terms of how the landscape was before, how was the water. Interview your parents in terms of how much water was in the river, so that there's a historical angle to looking at issues broadly.
And why women?
Women, when I was working in conservation, were our particular stakeholder. In South Africa, you still have highly a migratory labor environment where the men go to the mines or they go to the city as the main providers. So the women are left at home. They're looking after the cattle. They're looking after their huts. They need to make sure that their huts have grass on them, fresh grass. So they're the people that really understand natural resources and they're highly dependent on them. And they're the collectors. They're the ones who go and collect. So they were critical stakeholder. And when we had to look at issues of developmental projects, we had to focus mainly on the women. It was not actually even an issue of choice, because when you went to the meetings or you organized meetings, the majority of people that would attend would be the women.
And could you say a little bit about the research that you're conducting now?
My research is in the Kalahari. It's looking at power-knowledge relationships between one of the sand groups called the Komani and South African National Parks, the park, because the Komani were one group in South Africa that was not provided for in terms of land. When they were kicked out of the park in 1932, they became refugees in their own country.
And are you looking at women specifically within that, or a gendered aspect of that?
I'm looking at issues broadly, but the Komani are very much, the women are very much in the background. It's mainly the men that are in the forefront. Mm. And they are the ones that have actually been instrumental in defining the kind of life that would be left, they would live while they were refugees within South Africa. So, but I do have quite a close relationship with quite a number of the women. Ngati, for instance, and the wife of Omfet Piet, one of the greatest trekkers. And at another level, you look at their needs. When her husband died and they were evicted out of the park by the park manager, she approached me in terms of saying, look, I don't have a house. What do we do? Because I've always lived in the park and my husband now is dead. What do we do? But it's always difficult to provide and come up with answers, because sometimes it goes beyond the institution. It goes to the personal in terms of how can you help.
And what do you feel like there are specific issues that you think are really critical that need to be addressed, both in terms of things that you've learned for your research, but just looking at broadly in terms of South Africa or in terms of the world in general, in terms of the environment, that are not being given as much attention as they need?
I think in terms of my research particularly, we are seeing a group of people, the Komani, that are sort of living a schizophrenic lifestyle, and it's not of their making. It's just the entanglement that they've been forced into. They're dying of HIV infections. There's alcoholism. And it's because of the pressure that we're putting them on. At one point, we want them to be, we want them to exhibit their culture. And having spoken to one of them, Maria, she was saying to me, look, Sibongile, the Bushmen want beautiful clothes. They want life, they want money, they want all these things that everybody wants. So when you people plan, you must consider these things. I want to have my stall inside the park, not outside the park. It's my park. Why should my stall be outside the park? So those are the real hard issues some of the women are struggling with in terms of understanding what their needs are. And I think in a way, you have these moments in history where, for instance, they won their land claim. But then what happened afterwards? So we're always, when it comes to issues of redress, we drag our feet and hide behind policy. And when it comes to conservation, we want to make sure that the so-called thresholds are not interfered with. But we never stop to say, can we ask common sense to prevail here? Generally, most of the indigenous people's movements, it's really pathetic how some of them are perishing because we want them to play dual roles. We want them to sit in conferences and speak the language of inside, yet they've been outside. We do things at our own pace and we disregard their pace. When it comes to policy, we are slow. But when we want to see changes, they must move fast. So it's one of the issues that when we deal with indigenous communities, we revise the concept of time.
It strikes me just listening to your stories that, you know, in the West, we sort of learned about the post-apartheid era in South Africa and sort of what needs to happen in terms of race relations to move forward in the country. But there wasn't necessarily any mention of the environment and kind of how that's woven in and how sort of the everyday experiences that people have trying to survive, trying to meet their basic needs are really a critical piece of that. I think we, you know, we hear about the history and we hear about racial divisions, but we don't hear about the environmental impact of those things. So I was just struck, I just wanted to reflect that that was very striking to me, and that somehow that piece of it seems to be missing.
Yes, I think if you look at the particular, I'm using the Khomani as an example here, that their lifestyle was mainly in hunting and gathering. And all of a sudden they're outside of that. They've been living as refugees. They come back to their, to the Kalahari. And there is no space in our thinking or the creativity in our thinking to say, what do we do in order that the people can feel like they're back in their space? Fine, they've been exposed to other ways of life. But there needs to be some way of creativity in terms of rethinking what their new role in the space that they owned before is. I mean, I know conservation doesn't provide many jobs, but the kind of jobs that are being developed is construction of roads. You ask some of the Khomani, they said, no, the Khomani people don't work on roads. It's too dirty. It's for the other people. We are hunters. So, and the acceptance of that to say, well, look, if this is part of their new culture, or rather, they don't feel like working on the roads, what alternatives can we come up with in terms of within the environment? And I think at the same time, there are lots of restrictions that come with conservation institutions. They won land, 25,000 of hectares in the park, but they can't just walk in. They have to have a guard with them, to walk with them in there. So it puts, you can have the land, but you don't have the land. because of the restrictions that come with conservation. So it's a paradox. And the skate times, you can't just walk into the park at any time. When they were doing the trekking, I was asking some of them, are you allowed to sleep outside in the field so that you can hear the sounds of the animal? No, they're not allowed. But the researchers were doing research on the African wild cat, doing research on the leopard. They can sleep in the wild, but the people who own the land, they don't have those rights. So it's actually still quite, we still have a long way to walk in terms of recognizing people's rights.
You've been listening to South African conservationist Sibongile Masuku in conversation with Masu Mamaya, curator for Women, Power, and Politics at the International Museum of Women in San Francisco. Women, Power, and Politics is a groundbreaking multimedia, multilingual online exhibition.
So you were listening to a piece by Sibongile Masuku Van Dam, who is a researcher and environmental activist, who basically is based in South Africa. You are listening to Amandla, which is produced by the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. And we're going to go on now to some music. This is the end of the show. Thank you very, very much for listening. And we will be back with you next week on 88.1 FM CKLN.
This is Andrea Babington of Unite Here Local 75. And I'm also executive board member of Toronto's Labour Council. We want to give respect to Norman Otis Richmond for 25 years on the air playing conscious music and invite the listeners to learn about our exciting Hotel Workers Rising campaign at www.laborcouncil.ca.
folks coming home and finding all their possessions gone.
And you are listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. And Dr. Gerald Horn is in Europe. And he will not be on the show this week. And we're going to have a discussion on the recently conducted elections here in Canada. We have a few moments, and then we're going to be speaking with Abdul Al-Kalimat. And Melinda, what are your thoughts on the fact that we have this conservative majority, although only, I think they only got like, they didn't even get 40% of the, it was 58% of the people voted, and only less than 40% voted for the conservatives. So this is a so-called majority. What do you think about that?
I think it's just a big joke. And I was, you know, I was going through like my head when I was election, because I was deciding if I was going to vote or not. And I broke down and I actually voted. I guess it's routine. But I was really angry. I can't believe we have a majority conservative government. Like, what's going to happen? I don't know. Bye-bye healthcare.
Do you think they can actually get rid of all of those? How long do you think it'll take for them to dismantle that stuff, or can they actually do it?
I think they could do. I mean, like, if you know, Harris did it pretty quickly. So that's how they operate. They do it quickly, they dismantle and start selling. I mean, it's gonna happen, I think. So hopefully people are ready to start fighting, though. This is my hope. Maybe it'll kick people in the butt.
Well, it looks like it's going to have to be resolved through not through parliament, but through, I guess, it's going to be settled on the streets. Don't you think that the new immigrants and the social movements and the unions, do you think that there is a chance of them coming together and forming some sort of fight back?
Yeah, that's totally the hope. I mean, that's our only avenue to fight back. So, I mean, I think it's necessary. I hope it happens quickly, though. I mean, I've been saying about I don't know why that the movements, it takes so long to sort of build those relationships, and how in the right they do it so quickly. So I don't know. We have to get our shit together.
The number here is 416-595-1655, 416-595-1655. If you have any thoughts on the election, we really would like to know who is listening to Saturday Morning Live this morning, and the number here is 416-595-1655. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we are here with you until 1 p.m. Hopefully we can get Abdul Al-Kalimat at 12 o'clock and we can discuss the new Manning Marable book. That should be very, very interesting. 416-595-1655.
May I speak, sir?
Go ahead.
All right. I have the the Globe and Mail from Wednesday, May 4th, 2011. The Harper economic agenda is on the front here. Anyhow, it says there's a little conservative majority. There's a little story here. Stephen Chase of Calgary writes, and here's the headline for his article, The New PM, Ambitious Agenda, Relaxed Tone, Moderate Message. What would you consider a moderate message coming from your prime minister?
I can barely hear you.
What would you consider to be... Are you hearing me now?
Oh, loud and clear.
Okay. What would you consider a moderate message coming out of Stephen Harper?
Oh, the mere fact that he claimed that he was going to be... He implied that he was going to be conciliatory. I thought he would just jump on the mic and say, you know, we've taken over.
Well, here's an omnibus crime bill containing a far-reaching rewrite of justice laws to fulfill their tough-on-crime agenda.
So...
That's moderate. According to the Globe and Mail.
Moderate.
Well, what do you expect from the Globe and Mail, though? Seriously.
Well, this is my point, man. Like, he's anxious to position the Tories as a mainstream government that would rule closer to the center. Like, the center is so far to the right now. Are these people for real? Like, I don't understand how people... Boy, it's fun. Canadian politics is fun. Do you know... I was watching CPAC during the election. I'm an addict when there's an election. You know what? I love politics. I just would never get involved myself because I take it. It's too, you know, it's crazy. But I love watching it as a blood sport. And I was watching CPAC during the election, and they had Danielle Smith on a radio talk show, like, because they were doing some of their programming on CPAC was to take a live radio talk show, take their cameras in there, like what was normally a radio talk show, have them do their show. And then, so while they were doing radio commercials, CPAC cameras would still be rolling and you'd hear them talking and blah, blah, blah. And they had Danielle Smith on this radio talk show. I think the guy was in Calgary, but it was at West somewhere, some radio, you know, AM talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Canadian style. And, do you know who Danielle Smith is?
No.
Danielle Smith is the leader of a party called the Wild Rose Alliance. It's a provincial party in Alberta. And essentially, I'll just sum it up for you like this. The Wild Rose Alliance, because you know the progressive conservative, not the conservative at the national level, but still the provincial progressive conservative party in Alberta, hasn't lost an election since they were first elected in like 1971.
Wow.
Yeah. It's quite a string they've got going. It's like Cal Ripken. But they, here's the thing with the Wild Rose Alliance. Because so you've had PC, you know, conservative, progressive conservative party governance for 40 years.
Right.
The Wild Rose Alliance is a new party in the last 3 or 4 years cropped up because the PCs aren't white right wing enough for them.
Well, don't you think they have what they have?
Oh, go ahead.
I'm wondering what's going on in this country that, you know.
Like, so.
How is that sanity?
So what are they, like, how, like, what are their different, how, what's their different differentiation from
I'm not really sure what their party policy is, but right. I just know that, I know from reading, well, I have read it. I don't know it offhand. I don't have it. Maybe I should look it up on the internet. Yeah. Hey, welcome to the 1990s. But I'm going to look it up. But yeah, they're more right wing. That's their thing, man.
Like, yeah, but the thing about, I agree with George Bernard Shaw that, you know, the majority of people did not vote. And it's a question of,
well, there you go.
The people have to determine whether or not they're going to choose between socialism and barbarism. That's how I see it.
Well, they're choosing barbarism, obviously. I mean, what conclusion can you draw?
That's the whole, if there's hell below, we're all going to go type of thing. But
No, it's not a matter of that.
Wild people in Venezuela have chosen socialism. People in Bolivia have chosen socialism.
We're
part of the whole world. So let's talk about the where Canada fits into the whole situation. If there's a hell below, I think that... the world.
Well, there's no hell below. So
no,
don't
but
worry
I'm just.
It,
but I'm saying the world is changing.
That's a Christian.
Changing
myth.
From for the better. I think the world is changing for the world is moving to the left.
No, I disagree, Norman. I think it's consolidation period, and the whenever empires are trying to consolidate power, that's always a right wing swing, and that's what's happening.
Right wing swing where?
On the top.
Where?
Maybe.
Where? Where's the right wing swing?
Well, we have a conservative government at the city level, at the national level. We're going to have a conservative government after the next provincial election. You know, the Republicans are in control of the Congress. They had George Bush for 8 years. I mean, even Bill Clinton was right of center. He wasn't, by any stretch of the imagination, a left-leaning Democrat. You know, Bill
Clinton, and so was
Jean Chrétien. Even the liberals of the 90s, they were the ones who were cutting $25 billion in programs.
The liberals are a capitalist party, just like the Democratic Party. But I'm saying that the majority of the world has rejected capitalism. The majority of the world.
I disagree. China's a capaliest country, even though the Communist Party is in charge. But China is not a capitalist system.
They're not a capitalist country. They have a mixed economy, and there's a struggle going on.
So that's close enough. Hey, we got a call. That's close enough. Here we go. I'm going to kill my mic so we don't get feedback.
Saturday Morning Live. Hello? Hello?
Yes. Hi, Norman. How are you?
Pretty good. We only have a few minutes before we... So please, I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay, sure. Yeah, the election, I'm actually finding your conversation very interesting because I think what's actually going on is a lot of politics is not necessarily right-wing anymore, but in fact it's corporatized. And I think that's really the shift that's going on. In certain places of the world where you're seeing people power, like you mentioned in Bolivia and things like that, you can call it socialism, but what it actually is real democracy. But what's happening here in America, North America, and lots of places in Europe is that there's an actual corporatization. And, in fact, this corporatization seems to suggest that it's okay to lie to your people. So, you know, Harper feels he can come up and give some conciliatory speech and all of this kind of stuff so he can look like the prime minister, but at the end of the day, they are going to pass policies and agendas that fit with their ideology as opposed to what the research tells them is good for the country, what is necessary for the people. You know what I mean?
Okay, but we're going to have to get off the phone, but I'm saying that there's different types of socialism. There's Fabian socialism, then there's scientific socialism, and the type of socialism that people are talking about in South America is not necessarily the same type of socialism that they're talking about in Cuba. And when I'm talking about socialism, I just want to make it clear that I understand Fabian socialism, which is like the mild socialism, then there's scientific socialism, which, you know, Comandante Raul Castro and people like that are believing. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah. Well, again, I just think that there is an agenda which believes it's okay to deceive people in the interest of getting what you think is right, and ultimately might is right. And I just see that over and over and over again. For example, you know, the Oscar was won by that documentary filmmaker who talked about all of these people in the financial services industry who perpetrated a fraud, a global fraud. But no one has ever been arrested on this matter. No one has even had to face the people in public court. And, you know, there was this lecture about this very fact that I listened to the other day, and one of the comments that was made was that when... what was his name? The guy who was running the Fed before Geithner, you know, with the
Summer, was
guy
it
with
Summer,
the
Summer,
and stuff.
Summers?
Yeah, when he was there, he remembered talking to a bunch of people, and he said that when he made a position about this being good, he actually had his fingers crossed for the non-Americans in the group that he was talking to, because in America, it's considered good strategy to whitewash, to get people to buy into your situation so that you can do what you want, even if it is to sell a product, for example, that isn't going to give anybody anything but the impression that maybe they're socially conscious.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And then
can I just give you this quick little bit of info then, Norman?
Yeah, go ahead, and then we have to try to get Abdul.
One of the policies of the Wild Rose Alliance is an Alberta constitution. A Wild Rose government will defend Albertans against intrusions by the federal government by protecting the property, legal, constitutional, and democratic rights of Albertans. So it's starting to sound like a Bloc Québécois they got going on over there. Nice, huh?
Interesting.
Can we take a musical break and come try to get Abdul Al-Kalimat? And you are listening to Saturday Morning Live.